This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So I do my best to make the talk accessible both to people here for the first time and also interesting for the people who've been coming every week for the last months and years. On this Monday night class, I've been since the New Year's, doing a series of teachings on the core teachings of the life of the Buddha and the core teachings of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. If you come to this class every week for a couple of years, you'll hear everything that the Buddha taught within a year or two. You'll hear it all. You'll hear pretty much everything that is the core teachings of the Buddha from the Pali Canon. You'll hear some version of almost all of it. Actually, some people who are practicing for a long time, they get a little bored. They say, I've already heard that teaching like three times. Isn't there anything new? So repetitive. Then people start jumping from tradition to tradition, looking for a different way to hear this very simple teaching. Maybe the Japanese will teach me the exact same thing in a different way. Or maybe the Tibetans will teach me the exact same thing in a more colorful way. So where I'm at in this series of teachings is on the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path. That means something to some of you. And it is the teachings from the Buddha on mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, the teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness. And I am on the fourth foundation of mindfulness. You missed the first three, sorry. I think I've probably given maybe six teachings on the first three foundations. I think I did maybe three or four just on the first foundation, which is the first direction about mindfulness of the breath and mindfulness of the body and activities and postures of the body. Also on the, there's a meditation in the first foundation on death, on the impermanence of the body and the physical death, and working with that as a mindfulness practice, being mindful of our own impermanence, breaking the denial and the delusion that this body is going to last, and really turning towards the fact of impermanence and decay. And the second foundation on the Buddha directs us to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings in the body. Also in the mind, the third foundation. I think last time I was here, a couple weeks ago, I did the third foundation of really turning our attention, bringing mindfulness, present time awareness, to the formations in the mind, what we call thoughts and emotions. The first foundation is about learning to ignore your mind and just live in your body. Really important skill to learn to be able to choose whether or not you're identified with your thinking mind, whether you're thinking the thoughts that are arising and seeing that there are both volitional and non-volitional thoughts. Some of the thoughts you're thinking, some of the thoughts are thinking themselves. This fourth foundation of mindfulness, I think I might have to do at least two or three talks to really get through it, because the Buddha throws out a lot here. This fourth foundation of mindfulness is referred to as the Dhammas, and Dhamma is this Pali word that translates as truth. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, the Buddha, the awakened one, Dhamma, the teaching or the truth. that we can experience and Sangha community. And so in the fourth foundation, he's saying the Dhammas, turn your attention towards the truth of your experience. You've now trained your attention in breath, body awareness, feeling tone awareness, and thought awareness. Firmly established present time awareness in the body with the feeling tones, and no longer ignoring the mind, but including the mind. What's arising and passing, knowing it, naming it, meditating with the mind. This is really important. This kind of meditation is not about stopping your mind, and it's certainly not about ignoring it forever. A lot of people come to these classes and they hear the be mindful of your breath, and then they think, for some reason, they think that that's what they're supposed to do forever. Always ignore your mind and come back to your breath. This is not what the Buddha's teaching. This is only the beginning place. Be with the breath, ignore your mind. Fairly quickly, we grow out of this ignoring of the mind, and we turn towards observing the mind. Buddhist meditation is about training our mind, knowing our mind, not stopping it and not ignoring it forever. And beginning to see what's true, what's happening right now. Fourth foundation. Starting with a real mindful investigation of the sense doors, just there's seeing happening. Even with your eyes closed in meditation, you're seeing something. And there's both images from the behind the kind of, for me, it feels like shapes and colors behind my closed eyelids. And so there's that experience of seeing. And then there's also mental images. Also, your mind thinks in pictures, perhaps you've noticed. And even though your eyes are closed, it's actually, you can name it as seeing. There's a way in which the brain, the mind is receiving it, very similar to eyes open sights. There's mental images, shapes, colors. And then even right now, with your eyes open, you can continue to meditate. Mindfulness of seeing, shapes, colors, people. The Buddha says, just seeing and what is seen. So what he's directing us towards is cutting out the concept of what you're seeing. Like even right now, as I appear in your vision, you're looking at me, and right away the mind says, person, maybe man, maybe goatee, whatever your mind, tattoos, whatever labels. But all of the labels that you put on me are concepts based on memory. Man, human, male, gender, all of that, relatively true, ultimately based on memory. It's a concept. The direct experience, seeing, shape, form. The four elements constituted in this thing that we call the human body. And so part of what the Buddha is trying to help us is break our identification with our conceptual thinking and bring us into the direct experience. Just seeing. Do you get that? It's a little tricky, right? Because it's like, well, you know, you're a person. Yes, I'm a person. That's what we call this human form. But the direct experience is seeing the mind. Somebody had to teach you human, man, woman. All of that is based on memory. There are concepts. The direct experience, just seeing. Same with hearing. Even right now, the sound, if you didn't speak English, you just sounds. You right away, your mind is recognizing these sounds as words. But the direct experience is just hearing. Just hearing. Sounds arise and pass. In the room, my voice, outside of the room, cars going by. But even that, car, concept, just hearing. Yes, we call that metal with a internal combustion motor, right? We call that a car or a motorcycle, but it's just hearing. Motorcycle is a concept based on memory. That's what we label that. It's useful to see how the mind works and the instant labeling. The direct experience, just seeing in what is seen, just hearing in what is heard. Likewise with smelling, with tasting. What's your direct experience of this moment? I heard one teacher say, just imagine that you were an alien and you just inhabited this human form and you didn't have any names for any of this stuff. That's part of what the Buddha is trying to direct us to. This is just the direct experience, pre-conceptual, the direct, and it would just be sound and it would just be, I don't know the whole story. I probably shouldn't tell it, but I will anyways.
Good.
Something about somebody who had not had sight their whole life, and then something happened and they were able to restore the person's sight. And they had sound. They had heard. So they lived without seeing. And then when they could see, they weren't able to put edges to what they were seeing. It took a really long time. They just saw like blobs. And you would think like it would just be like opening your eyes and then there would be like sharp edges to everything and differentiation. But there was something about this person was just seeing the four elements. He didn't have a conceptual relationship to it. His whole life had just been hearing without sight. Just seeing. Color, shape. Energy. So a lot of what we experience moment to moment, the sense doors, phenomena being stimulated, smell, taste, sound. In the body, sensations, all of the different sensations, even right now, mindfulness, what's it feel like sitting here? Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? How do you relate to the pleasant moments? Is there clinging? Is there craving? Attachment? How about the unpleasant sensations? How much resistance, aversion, anger, hatred? Do we meet our pain with? We begin to watch the mind, know the mind, receive what's arising. And the mind is heart and mind. The heart, the emotions are categorized in this way under the mind. Heart mind. As we pay attention in this way, we begin to see the different mind states. When lust is present, we know it. When fear is present, when anger, also when joy is present, when calm, peace is present. Knowing it. Oh, this is what it feels like. Like I said in the meditation, the Buddha actually puts in the Four Noble Truths into our meditation practice. He says, mindfulness of dukkha, tanha, nirodha. Mindfulness of suffering. When you are suffering, which is like most of the time. and suffering in this way doesn't mean extreme suffering. It just means lack of total ease. Anytime you're uneasy. Anytime you're dissatisfied, anytime you're experiencing stress, He invites us, the instruction is turn our attention towards it. Mindfulness of dukkha, of uneasiness, of stress. What's it, you know, what's it feel like? Where is it in my body? What's happening in my belly, in my shoulders, in my jaw, when I'm experiencing stress or suffering? How do I carry that suffering, that uneasiness physically? What's happening emotionally around it? That maybe sometimes our emotions are giving rise to the uneasiness, or the uneasiness may be giving rise to an emotion. Chicken or the egg sometimes. What's coming first? This tension in my belly or the fear? Or the fear making my belly tense? Which one? Looking at it. Mindfulness. Investigating it. Suffering as a meditation practice. Dukkha. Turning your attention towards it. Let it be a central part of what you meditate on, what you investigate. And it's not thinking about it, but it's bringing mindfulness to it. What is it in my body, in my heart, in my mind? The second noble truth, tanha, craving. Tanha translates as craving, and craving has the connotation of both attachment and aversion. Both what we're holding on to. Usually when it's pleasant, there's some clinging. Your body, your survival instinct kicks in and says, I like this, and we try to hold on to it. We cling to the pleasant moments. Or if it's unpleasant, if it's painful, the feeling tone is unpleasant, then often there's a reaction of aversion, of trying to get rid of, pushing away. Bringing mindfulness to that process as it's unfolding right here in you. Not intellectually, not thinking about it, not studying it on paper. Studying it in you. What is it? Your direct experience of craving. What are the sensations? What are the emotions? What are the thoughts connected with craving in you? And what's the difference? And I think this is important for each of us to know really clearly. What's the difference between craving in your direct experience and desire? Meditating on what's it feel like to want something versus what does it feel like to have the feeling and the thought, I have to have it. This has to go away in order for me to be happy. Or I have to get A, B, or C in order to be happy. Craving feels like I have to have. Desire, I want, but I could be okay without it. It's not the source. I want something, but it's not the source of my happiness. I can be completely at ease with or without getting my desires fulfilled. Craving dictates whether or not we can be at ease. I can't be happy, I can't be at ease until I satisfy this craving as how it feels to me. Mindfulness of suffering in you, craving in you, physically, emotionally. Mindfulness of nirvana. So most of us feel like, well, nirvana, that means enlightenment, nibbana. I don't ever experience that. I'm not enlightened yet. But I think that the Buddha is actually pointing towards, and there was a Thai forest meditation master named Bhikkhu Buddhadasa. And he wrote this wonderful book about everyday nirvana. And pointing towards this teaching from the Buddha on the fourth foundation, pointing towards the third noble truth, Nibbana or Nirvana, as part of our mindfulness practice. saying all of those moments throughout the day, especially if you've been meditating for a while, but maybe even if you haven't, all of those moments throughout the day where you're not attached to anything. You're not craving for it to be different than it is. You're satisfied. Even if it's only for a half a breath. Even if it's only for a moment. And many of us feel like, I'm never fucking satisfied. But maybe there are some of those moments. And the more you meditate, and the more you practice non-attachment, and the more you practice compassion towards the pain, you'll find more and more of those moments where even if it's unpleasant, you're at ease with it. You're satisfied in discomfort. Not hating it, but meeting it with compassion. So he's pointing towards acknowledging those moments as nirvana, as a little mini, a little taste of enlightenment. Moments of the cessation of suffering. Nirvana literally means when suffering ends. It was actually a cooking term that meant to remove the cooking pot from the fire. The fire is greed, hatred, and delusion. It burns us. It cooks us. Nirvana is chilling out. Not getting burned. Extinguishing the causes of suffering. Removing ourselves from the flames. Nirvana doesn't mean that there's no pain present. This is really important. Nirvana means you're just not meeting the pain with hatred. Right? Hatred is a flame that causes suffering. Aversion causes suffering. Pain is just unpleasant. It's just an unpleasant sensation, emotion, feeling, thought. Hating pain causes a whole level of unnecessary anguish, mental anguish. Emotional anguish, suffering. So these mini nirvanas can even be in the midst of unpleasant experiences. Or in the midst of pleasure. Pleasure, nothing wrong with pleasure. Pleasure is good, we like pleasure. But as soon as we cling to it, as soon as we attach to it, we turn it into suffering. Because it's impermanent, we experience the grief of loss as soon as we get attached to the pleasant experience. So nirvana can also be these mini mindfulness of a cessation, can be in the midst of a pleasant experience that you're not clinging to. Mindfulness of this is what it's like to meet a pleasant experience with non-attached enjoyment. Non-clinging appreciation. And it's very important to direct our attention towards it, to not blow it off, to not ignore it, but to meditate with it, to be present for all of the moments of non-suffering in our life, as much as possible. Maybe where it's easiest to recognize is in the neutral moments. For many people, it's not painful, it's not pleasant. There's all of those experiences, those places in the body that are neutral. They don't hurt, they don't really feel good. There's neither pleasure nor pain involved or perceived. And so, therefore, there doesn't have to be, there's not as automatic of clinging. You don't really cling to neutrality or you're not really pushing it away. Depends on your conditioning. I know for myself, in the beginning, I found it hard to tolerate the neutral experiences. I thought I was meditating because I wanted to be more peaceful, but when I started to experience peace after years of meditating, I didn't really like it. I was so addicted to intensity and intense pleasure and intense pain, that the neutral moments and the peaceful moments and the non-suffering moments felt boring. And it took some time to get used to being at ease. without being entertained, without being intensely stimulated by pleasant or unpleasant experience. And to learn to have cessation, non-suffering, around, rather than going and looking for trouble, right? Sometimes that's what it felt like to me. It's neutral, I'm looking for trouble. I'm going to start craving, I'm going to start rehashing an old resentment. Something more familiar than this peaceful moment. All of the factors of the Eightfold Path, mindfulness practices, understanding, intention, action, speech, effort, mindfulness. I wonder, can you be mindful of mindfulness? I'm not sure about that. But I guess so, because later in this fourth foundation, the Buddha talks about the seven factors, bringing mindfulness of the seven factors of awakening. And mindfulness is one of the seven factors. So there is a way in which he's saying, also, when mindfulness is present and established, bring mindfulness to mindfulness. I'm not sure exactly what that looks like, but just knowing. Now, this is mindfulness. This is what it's like to be paying attention to the present, not lost in the future, not lost in the past. Here, now, investigating this mind, body, heart process. Another experience of truth that the Buddha directs us to in the fourth foundation, I refer to in the meditation, the five hindrances. The five things that make meditation and the spiritual life very difficult. That hinder us, exactly what it sounds like. That hinder our progress, that hinder our liberation, that hinder our happiness. And the first two, I've already been speaking about some, and that's this very natural human tendency to crave for pleasure, to lust for pleasure, to cling to pleasure. Built-in survival instinct. We're just born into these human animal lusting bodies that just want things to feel good all of the time. And wanting things to feel good all of the time, craving, lusting for things to feel good all of the time, makes life really difficult because shit doesn't feel good all of the time. It's not realistic, right? Our survival instinct isn't in harmony with reality. And that craving for things to be else other than they are causes a lot of stress in our lives. Gets us into all kinds of repetitive. At the retreat we were just teaching, Joanna Harper, one of our teachers, was quoting one of those animal torture experiences, experiments, where they, you know, had the rats in the maze pushing the pleasure button, and that eventually the rats would push the pleasure button, I think until it killed them. So it was like hundreds and hundreds of times, and that it's just that built-in. It's the same as getting addicted to drugs or alcohol or behaviors that give temporary, pleasant experience. There's a sort of built-in thing in us where we just want pleasure. And for many of us, at any cost, at any consequence, those poor rats to the point of killing themselves by pushing, they weren't eating, they weren't mating, they just were pushing the crack button. Over and over and over. Death by pleasure. By addiction to pleasure. By escaping pain. Till it kills some of us or creates all kinds of problems in one's life. And not only for the drug addict, but for the everyday person. humanity is strung out on pleasant experiences. And it makes meditating kind of difficult because it doesn't always feel good. Right? You sit here, your body aches and you're mind is abusive, comparing you to everyone else, saying, I'm sure everyone in here is happy except for me. And everybody looks so peaceful, sitting still, and I can barely stand this shit. And how long until he rings the fucking bell?
Yeah, I thought that.
Craving for the bell to ring, craving for pleasure. I'll be happy when this shit is over. Aversion being the flip side, resistance to pain, again, just completely connected to our survival instincts. Of course, pain is a useful thing that tells us when we need to eat and when we need more warmth or less warmth. But there's a part of the mind and body that experiences pain as a threat. It goes into fight or flight. Feels like it has to avoid, it has to suppress. There's a part of the body, the survival instinct, that knows too much pain equals death. And then gets into this place of not being able to tolerate any pain. Fear of all discomfort. It makes meditating difficult because part of meditating is facing some discomfort in the body, unpleasant emotions, past pains that are going to re-arise in meditation. So our aversion to pain hinders our ability to sit still and see clearly. Hinders our ability to meditate. And takes some time to learn to tolerate pain and know that it's safe. Bring mindfulness directly to the aversion. Bring mindfulness directly to the craving. Get interested in it rather than obeying the cravings, the aversions. Sitting in it. This is aversion. This is craving. This is the hindrance of lust. This is the hindrance of hatred. Meditating with it. And the next two, also coupled, two sides of the coin. One side, restlessness, sitting, and the body's anxiousness and restlessness, and the mind's restlessness and anxiousness. Makes it difficult to sit still when you're anxious, when you're restless, when you're agitated. When the mind is agitated, it makes it difficult to settle into mindfulness, to really pay attention, to get concentrated. There has to be some amount of concentration to really benefit from these practices. And when you're anxious, it's hard. When you're restless, it's hard. But there's a space for actually being able to hold restlessness in mindfulness, to know this is restlessness, this is anxiety, and to turn your attention on it. It feels like this and racing thoughts in my mind, shortness of breath in my body, tightness in my belly, constriction. Turning your attention on anxiety and restlessness in the body, in the heart, in the mind. It's part of your practice. Or sloth and torpor is the way that the Buddha talks about the other side of that. when you're falling, you're trying to meditate and you just keep falling asleep and your mind is dull and your body is heavy. Makes it quite difficult, hinders our ability to see clearly when we're falling asleep all of the time. And there's two types of sleepiness, I think. There is the sleepiness of just you're ready for a nap. You're just tired. And when you first begin to meditate, your body is not used to closing its eyes. You're not used to closing your eyes very often, except for when it's nap time or bedtime. So the body gets this physical message that says, must be time for a nap, because she usually doesn't close her eyes at 7 o'clock unless she's going to bed. He usually doesn't close his eyes in the morning unless he wants to go back to sleep. So the body says, well, it must be sleep time. After meditating for a while, your body starts to understand it's not nap time. It's time to be actually very alert, very awake, very attentive. And then there's the kind of sloth and torpor that feels much more mental and psychological, like a dullness of mind. And it's not like you can be very awake in your body, but your mind just very foggy, very dull, unable to really concentrate, and to really land. If you haven't already, I invite you next time you're having this sort of sloth experience, whether it's a physical or a mental or both, investigate what's the feeling tone of it. Is it pleasant to be sleepy? Is it unpleasant? Is it a neutral feeling to have that kind of fog? I found for myself when I first started looking at it, I thought, I hate falling asleep. And then I realized that it was just the aversion to it that was unpleasant. I hate this. This must be unpleasant. But it was just the hatred of it that was unpleasant, because I was judging myself and I was like, I'm trying to meditate. I don't want to fall asleep every time I try to meditate. This is a waste of time. But when I started using it as my practice, bringing mindfulness to it, I saw that actually falling asleep feels really good. It's very pleasant to be nodding out during meditation if you just surrender to it. If you resist it, it sucks. But if you're just like, oh, I like this. I haven't had a nod like this in a while. Sometimes you might find that without aversion to sloth, to fogginess of mind, it's like, oh, wait, this is like, there's a fog between my consciousness and my suffering. I like not being so I like not being so wide awake to the causes of suffering. I like that fog when I can, right? It's like why people get high. Oh, yes. Sloth. I like this shit. Fogginess of mind. That feels good. That feels really good. Craving for pleasure. Attachment to pleasant experiences. It's interesting to look at these hindrances. The Buddha, sitting under the Bodhi tree, coming to enlightenment. Basically, he's practicing mindfulness. When, if you've heard the story of how he's attacked by Mara, Mara attacks with aversion. Mara attacks with lust and craving. Mara attacks with restlessness and sloth. Mara being the word in Buddhism for almost like the devil, the tempter. Mara is actually the Hindu Buddhist cosmology. It's the one who kills. It's like the grim reaper. Because Mara will kill your chances at happiness. Mara will kill will take away your liberation if you surrender to the Mara aspect of mind. So Mara is attacking. Mara is just the hindrances. And the Buddha is meditating under the Bodhi tree, and lust is coming and aversion is coming. And he's just paying attention to it. He's practicing the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And he's saying, I see you, Mara. I see you, lust. I see you, aversion. And he's relating to that aspect of being human. And he's meeting the aversion and the pain with compassion. And the lust and the craving and the clinging with non-attachment. With non-clinging. The last thing Mara does, the last and considered the most dangerous weapon of Mara and the most difficult hindrance to deal with, the fifth hindrance, that of doubt. The last thing Mara tries to attack the Buddha to be under the Bodhi tree with is doubt. It says, lust didn't work, violence didn't work. But you know what never fails on these weak human beings? Little self-doubt. Little low self-esteem. That works every time. And Mara attacks, the mind attacks, the hindrance arises of the traditional way. I think Mara says to the Buddha, the mind says, who do you think you are to be liberated? Everyone suffers. Everyone. Why do you think you're so special? Why do you think you're worthy? Or you can flip that around and that very common thought of or feeling, conscious or unconscious, conscious of, I'm not worthy. Low self-esteem, unworthiness, to be happy, to be free. Doubt in your own worth or your own capacity for change, transformation. The bad news is we all experience this, these hindrances, our whole life. The good news is through mindfulness, the Buddha was able to defeat Mara under the Bodhi tree and come to liberation. Freedom from suffering, full enlightenment, Nibbana, removed from greed, hatred, and delusion. The bad news is Mara kept coming back to the Buddha even after liberation. The hindrances don't go away. But how the Buddha responded is that he practiced with the hindrances. He was mindful of them. Doubt continued to arise. Fear continued to arise. It doesn't go away forever. Lust doesn't go away forever. Even if you're enlightened, even for the fully enlightened Buddha, it didn't go away forever. But with mindfulness, you have a skillful relationship to those difficult, afflictive emotions. Practicing the fourth foundation of mindfulness, we just include it. Right now, there's some craving present. I don't have to act on it. Right now, there's some aversion, there's some doubt, there's restlessness, there's torpor. And we relate to it with mindfulness rather than letting it push us around, rule our lives, dictate our speech and our actions. I think that's as far as I want to take the fourth foundation, because I'm going to start getting into the seven factors of awakening and I don't have time to go through them. So next time I'll talk about the seven factors. Any questions, comments, or clarifications about practicing in this way, please? I'm not sure how to talk about it because I'm not sure if I agree. His statement was that talking about fear, that his feeling is that greed, hatred, and delusion all stem from fear. And could I talk about that? So I'm not sure if I can because I think I might have a different perspective. I would, yeah. I might put fear as just on equal footing, not the core source of everything else, but on equal footing with what I really believe that we're contending with is just the survival instinct, and that actually fear is an important part of our survival instinct, as is the craving for pleasure and the aversion to pain, that this is just the built-in stuff in our nervous system, in our DNA, that keeps us alive. I heard my friend, colleague Vinny Ferraro talk about human beings. You know who survives in this evolution of species? The nervous animals survive. The ones that if you're not nervous, you just get eaten. If you don't have some fear, somebody just fucking eats you. You don't evolve without fear built into your DNA. Your species doesn't survive. Craving for pleasure also just feels like it's just totally naturally part of our human biological evolution. Fear, craving, aversion to pain, you have to have it. You know, in the first, I talked about it earlier, in the first foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha directs us to this practice that you spontaneously, reflection you had about death and about non-existence in this form, this physical form. From the beginning of our practice, it is meant to be part of our daily mindfulness practice, reflecting on impermanence and death. But there's so much, it's so counter, right, against the stream. It's so counter to our, so against what we want. We want to deny that. We want to, you know, this delusion of permanence. Again, built in, part of our defense mechanisms against impermanence. And it's wisdom. The wisdom of insecurity and impermanence and change and death and the inevitability of not existing in this way, moment to moment, and of course when the body stops breathing. Sometimes they'll talk in Buddhist circles, they'll talk about fearlessness. It doesn't seem realistic to me. It's a bit maybe like the conversation of craving versus desire. But I don't feel like, maybe a freedom from neurotic fear.
Yeah.
But some level of fear feels like it's going to continue with us in that sort of nervous survival necessity. A healthy sense of fear of stepping in front of the bus. Like, you should retain that healthy fear. Good to retain that healthy sense of, but not neurotic, not delusional, not. I think it's a decent place to end for tonight. I like to try to remember to end by saying that the Buddha was often, at least the way that it's recorded, of having ended teachings like this where it was very kind of a very strong statement, this is the way it is. This is the nature of reality. This is the way to practice for liberation. But then ending with a bit of a humility where he would say, "Now I've told you all that I know, but it's now time for you to decide what's true. It's time for you to decide to do what you see fit, to practice training your own mind and finding your own answers. I've told you all that I can. I've given you all of the knowledge, all of the wisdom that I have. But my knowledge and wisdom will do very little for you. You have to get your own. You have to make it your own. You have to embody these teachings. You have to live them. You have to come to wisdom for yourself, directly knowing. So don't believe these philosophies, but experience them for yourself. Make them your own.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.